that way to her, Merthyn said regretfully. But I just liked talking to her, especially after you turned to ice. She felt uncomfortable. I know, but Elizabeth feels cheated. The way she looks at me makes me nervous. Don't be afraid. She's a nun now. She can't do you any harm. They were quiet for a while, standing side by side, their shoulders touching intimately, watching the ritual. Bishop Richard sat on the throne at the east end, presiding over the service. Merthyn liked this sort of thing, Caris knew. He always felt better afterwards, and he said that was what going to church was supposed to do for you. Caris went because people noticed if she stayed away. But she had doubts about the whole business. She believed in God, but she was not sure he revealed his wishes exclusively to men such as her cousin Godwin. Why would a god want praise, for example? Kings and earls required worship, and the more petty their rank, the more deference they demanded. It seemed to her that an almighty god would not care one way or another whether the people of Kingsbridge sang his praises any more than she cared whether the deer in the forest feared her. She occasionally gave voice to these ideas, but no one took her seriously. Her thoughts drifted to the future. The signs were good that the king would grant Kingsbridge a borough charter. Her father would probably be the first mayor, if his health recovered. Her cloth business would continue to grow. Mark Webber would be rich. With increased prosperity, the parish guild could build a wool exchange so that everyone could do business comfortably, even in bad weather. Merthyn could design the building. Even the priory was going to be better off, though Godwin would not thank her. The service came to an end, and the monks and nuns began to process out. A novice monk broke out of line and entered the congregation. It was Philemon. To Caris's surprise, he approached her. "May I have a word?" he said. She repressed a shudder. There was something loathsome about Gwenda's brother. "What about?" she replied, barely politely. "I want to ask your advice, really," he said, with an attempt at a charming smile. "You know Mattie Wise?" "Yes." "What do you think of her methods?" She gave him a hard look. Where was this going? She decided she had better defend Mattie anyway. She has never studied the texts of the ancients, of course. Despite that, her remedies work, sometimes better than those of the monks. I think it's because she bases her treatments on what has worked previously, rather than on a theory about the humours. People standing nearby were listening with curiosity, and some of them now joined in uninvited. "She gave our Nora a potion that brought her fever down," said Madge Webber. John Constable said, "When I broke my arm, her medicine took the pain away while Matthew Barber set the bone." Philemon said, "And what kind of spells does she pronounce when she's making her mixtures?" "No spells," Caris said indignantly. "She tells people to pray when they take their medicines, because only God can heal, she says." "Could she be a witch?" "No, it's a ridiculous idea. Only there has been a complaint to the ecclesiastical court." A chill gripped Caris. "From whom?" "I can't say, but I've been asked to investigate." Caris was mystified. Who could Mattie's enemy be? She said to Philemon, "Well, you of all people know Mattie's worth. She saved the life of your sister when she gave birth to Sam. Gwenda would have bled to death if not for Mattie."
"So it seems."
"Seems? Gwenda's alive, isn't she?"
"Yes, of course."
"So you feel sure Mattie does not call on the devil?" Caris noticed that he asked the question in a slightly raised voice, as if he wanted to make sure the listeners around heard it. She was puzzled, but she had no doubt of her answer. "Of course I'm sure. I'll swear an oath if you want."
"Not necessary," Philemon said smoothly. "Thank you for your advice."
He inclined his head in a sort of bow and slithered away. Caris and Merthyn walked towards the exit.
"What rubbish," Caris said. "Mattie, a witch."
Merthyn looked troubled. "You would expect Philemon to want evidence against her, wouldn't you?"
"Yes."
"So why did he come to you?" He could have guessed that you, of all people, would deny the charge. Why would he be keen to clear her name?
I don't know.
They passed through the great west doorway and out onto the green. The sun was shining on hundreds of stalls loaded with colorful goods.
It doesn't make sense, Merthyn said, and that troubles me.
Why?
It's like the cause of weakness in the South Isle. If you can't see it, it may be working away invisibly to undermine you, and you won't know it until everything comes crashing down all around.
The scarlet cloth on Caris's market stall was not as good as that sold by Loro Fiorentino, although you had to have a sharp eye for wool to see the difference. The weave was not so close, because the Italian looms were somehow superior. The color was just as bright, but it was not perfectly even over the length of the bale, no doubt because Italian dyers were more skilled. In consequence, she charged 1/10 less than Loro. All the same, it was easily the best English scarlet that had ever been seen at Kingsbridge, and business was brisk. Mark and Madge sold it retail by the yard, measuring and cutting for individual customers, and Caris dealt with wholesale buyers, negotiating reductions for one bale or six with drapers from Winchester, Gloucester, and even London. By midday on Monday, she knew she would sell out before the end of the week. When business slowed down for the dinner break, she strolled around the fair. She felt a profound sense of satisfaction. She had triumphed over adversity, and so had Merthyn. She stopped at Perkins' stall to talk to the Wigley folk. Even Gwenda had triumphed. Here she was, married to Wulfric, something that had seemed impossible. And there was her baby, Sammy, a year old, sitting on the ground, fat and happy. Annette was selling eggs from a tray, as always, and Ralph had gone to France to fight for the king, and might never come back. Farther on she saw Joby, Gwenda's father, selling his squirrel furs. There was a wicked man, but he seemed to have lost his power to hurt Gwenda. Caris stopped at her own father's stall. She had persuaded him to buy fleece in smaller quantities this year. The international wool market could not possibly thrive when the French and English were raiding one another's ports and burning ships.
"How is business?" she asked him.
"Steady," he said. "I think I've judged it about right." He forgot that it had been her judgment, not his, that had counseled caution. But that was all right. Their cook, Tutty, appeared with Edmund's dinner, mutton stew in a pot, a loaf of bread and a jug of ale. It was important to look prosperous, but not overly so. Edmund had explained to Caris many years ago that although customers needed to believe they were buying from a successful business, they would resent contributing to the wealth of someone who appeared to be rolling in money.
"Are you hungry?" he asked her.
"Starving."
He stood up to reach for the stew pot. Then he staggered, made an odd sound halfway between a grunt and a cry, and fell to the ground. The cook screamed. Caris cried, "Father!" But she knew he would not respond. She could tell he was unconscious by the way he hit the earth, inertly heavy, like a sack of onions. She fought down the urge to scream. She knelt beside him. He was alive and breathing hoarsely. She grasped his wrist and felt his pulse. It was strong, but slow. His face seemed flushed. It was always reddish, but now it seemed more so than usual.
Tutty said, "What is it? What is it?"
Caris forced herself to speak calmly. "He's had a fit," she said. "Fetch Mark Webber. He can carry Father into the hospital." The cook ran off. People from the neighboring stalls gathered around. Dick Brewer appeared and said, "Poor Edmund, what can I do?" Dick was too old and fat to lift Edmund. Caris said, "Mark's coming to take him to the hospital." She began to cry.
"I hope he'll be all right," she said.
Mark appeared. He lifted Edmund easily, cradling him gently in his strong arms, and walked towards the hospital, negotiating his way through the crowds, calling,
"Mind out there! Out of the way, please! Injured man! Injured man!"
Caris followed, distraught. She could hardly see through her tears, so she stayed close to Mark's broad back. They reached the hospital building and went inside. Caris was grateful to see the familiar, knobbly face of old Julie.
"Fetch Mother Cecilia as quick as you can," Caris said to her.
The old nun hurried away, and Mark laid Edmund on a pallet near the altar. Edmund was still unconscious, eyes closed, breathing hoarsely. Caris felt his forehead. He was neither hot nor cold. What had caused this? It had been so sudden. One moment he had been talking normally, the next he fell down unconscious. How could such a thing happen? Mother Cecilia came. Her bustling efficiency was reassuring. She knelt beside the pallet and felt Edmund's heart, then his pulse. She listened to his breathing and touched his face.
"Get him a pillow and a blanket," she said to Julie. "Then fetch one of the monk physicians."
She stood up and looked at Caris.
"He's had a fit," she said. "He may recover. All we can do is make him comfortable. The physician may recommend bleeding, but apart from that, the only treatment is prayer."
That was not good enough for Caris. "I'm going for Matty," she said. She ran out of the building and dodged through the fair, remembering that she had done exactly the same thing a year ago, rushing to fetch Matty when Gwenda was bleeding to death. This time it was her father, and she felt a different kind of panic. She had been desperately worried about Gwenda, but now it was as if the world was falling apart. The fear that her father might die gave her the dreadful feeling she sometimes got in dreams when she found herself on the roof of Kingsbridge Cathedral with no way down but to jump. The physical effort of running through the streets calmed her a little, and she was in control of her emotions by the time she came to Matty's house. Matty would know what to do. She would say, "I've seen this before. I know what will happen next. Here's the treatment that helps." Caris banged on the door. Hearing no immediate answer, she impatiently tried the latch and found it open. She dashed inside, saying,
"Matty, you have to come to the hospital right away. It's my father."
The front room was empty. Caris pulled aside the curtain that screened off the kitchen. Matty was not there either. Caris said aloud,
"Oh, why would you be out of the house at this very moment?"
She looked around for some clue as to where Matty might have gone. Then she noticed how stripped the room appeared. All the little jars and bottles had gone, leaving the shelves bare. There were none of the mortars and pestles Matty used for grinding ingredients, none of her small pots for melting and boiling, no knives for chopping herbs. Caris returned to the front half of the house and saw that Matty's personal possessions had also disappeared. Her sewing box, her polished wood cups for wine, the embroidered shawl she had hung on the wall for decoration, the carved bone comb she treasured. Matty had packed up and gone. And Caris could guess why. Matty must have heard about Philemon's questions in church yesterday. Traditionally, the ecclesiastical court held a session on the Saturday of Fleece Fair week. Only 2 years ago, the monks had used the occasion for the trial of Crazy Nell on the absurd charges of heresy. Matty was no heretic, of course, but it was difficult to prove that, as many old women had learned. She had calculated her chances of surviving a trial and found the answer frightening. Without telling anyone, she had packed up her possessions and left town. Probably she had found a peasant returning home after selling his produce and persuaded him to take her on his ox cart. Caris imagined her leaving at first light, her box beside her on the cart, the hood of her cloak pulled forward to hide her face. No one could even guess where she had gone.
"What am I going to do?" Caris said to the empty room.
Matty knew better than anyone else in Kingsbridge how to help sick people. This was the worst possible moment for her to disappear, just when Edmund lay unconscious in the hospital. Caris felt despair. She sat down on Matty's chair, still panting from the effort of running. She wanted to run back to the hospital, but there was no point. She would not be able to help her father. Nobody could. The town must have a healer, she thought. One who does not rely on prayers and holy water or bleeding, but uses simple treatments that have been shown to work. And as she sat in Matty's empty house, She realized that there was one person who could fill the role, someone who knew Mattie's methods and believed in her practical philosophy. That person was Caris herself. The thought burst on her with the blinding light of a revelation, and she sat dead still, bewildered by the implications. She knew the recipes for Mattie's main potions, one for easing pain, one to cause vomiting, one for washing wounds, one to bring down a fever. She knew the uses of all the common herbs, dill for indigestion, fennel for fever, rue for flatulence, watercress for infertility. She knew the treatments Mattie never prescribed, poultices made with dung, medicines containing gold and silver, verses written on vellum and bound to the ailing part of the body. And she had an instinct for it. Mother Cecilia had said so, had practically pleaded with Caris to become a nun. Well, she was not going to enter the priory, but she might perhaps take Mattie's place. Why not? The cloth business could be run by Mark Webber. He was doing most of the work anyway. She would seek out other wise women, in Shiring, in Winchester, perhaps in London, and question them about their methods, what succeeded and what failed. Men were secretive about their craft skills, their mysteries, as they called them, as if there was something supernatural about tanning leather or making horseshoes, but women were usually willing to share knowledge with other women. She would even read some of the monks' ancient texts. There might be some truth in them. Perhaps the instinct that Cecilia attributed to her would help her winnow the seeds of practical treatment from the chaff of priestly mumbo-jumbo. She stood up and left the house. She walked slowly back, dreading what she would find at the hospital. She felt fatalistic now. Her father would either be all right, or he would not. All she could do was carry out her resolution so that in future, when the people she loved were sick, she would know she was doing everything possible to help them. She fought back tears as she made her way through the fair to the priory buildings. When she entered the hospital, she hardly dared look at her father. She approached the bed, which was surrounded by people. Mother Cecilia, old Julie, Brother Joseph, Mark Webber, Petronilla, Alice, Elfric. What must be, she thought. She touched the shoulder of her sister Alice, who moved aside, making room. At last, Caris looked at her father. He was alive and conscious, though he looked pale and tired. His eyes were open, and he looked straight at her and tried a weak smile. "I'm afraid I gave you a scare," he said. "I'm sorry, my dear."
"Oh, thank God," said Caris, and she began to cry.
On Wednesday morning, Merthyn came to Caris's stall in consternation. "Betty Baxter just asked me a strange question," he said. "She wanted to know who was going to stand against Elfric in the election for alderman."
"What election?" Caris said. "My father is alderman."
Oh. She realized what must be going on. Elfric was telling people that Edmund was too old and sick to fulfill the role, and the town needed someone new, and he was presenting himself as a candidate. "We must tell my father right away." Caris and Merthyn left the fairground and crossed the main street to the house. Edmund had left the priory hospital yesterday, saying, correctly, that there was nothing the monks could do for him but bleed him, which made him feel worse. He had been carried home, and a bed had been made up for him in the parlour on the ground floor. This morning he was reclining on a stack of pillows in his improvised bed. He looked so weak that Caris hesitated to bother him with the news, but Merthyn sat down beside him and laid out the facts darkly.
"Elfric is right," Edmund said when Merthyn had finished. "Look at me. I can hardly sit upright. The parish guild needs strong leadership. It's no job for a sick man."
"But you'll be better soon," Caris exclaimed.
"Perhaps. But I'm getting old. You must have noticed how absent-minded I've become. I forget things. And I was fatally slow to react to the downturn in the market for raw wool. I lost a lot of money last year."
Thank God we've rebuilt our fortune with the scarlet cloth. But you did that, Caris, not me. She knew all that, of course, but still she felt indignant. Are you just going to let Alfric take over? Certainly not. He would be a disaster. He's too much enthralled to Godwin. Even after we become a borough, we'll need an alderman who can stand up to the priory. Who else could do the job? Talk to Dick Brewer. He's one of the richest men in town, and the alderman must be rich to have the respect of the other merchants. Dick's not afraid of Godwin or any of the monks. He'd be a good leader.
Caris found herself reluctant to do as he said. It seemed like accepting that he was going to die. She could not remember a time when her father had not been alderman. She did not want her world to change. Merthyn understood her reluctance, but urged her on. "We have to accept this," he said. "If we ignore what's happening, we could end up with Alfric in charge. He would be a disaster. He might even withdraw the application for the borough charter." That decided her. "You're right," she said. "Let's find Dick." Dick Brewer had several carts in different locations in the fairground. Each bore a huge barrel. His children, grandchildren, and in-laws were selling ale from the barrels as fast as they could pour it. Caris and Merthyn found him setting an example by drinking a large pot of his own brew while he watched his family making money for him. They took him aside and explained what was going on. Dick said to Caris, "When your father dies, I suppose his fortune will be divided equally between you and your sister?" "Yes." Edmund had already told Caris that this was in his will. "When Alice's inheritance is added to Elfric's existing wealth, he will be very rich." Caris realized that half the money she was making from her scarlet cloth might go to her sister. She had not thought of this before, because she had not thought about her father dying. It came as a shock. Money itself was not important to her, but she did not want to help Elfric become alderman. "It's not just a question of who is the richest man," she said. "We need someone who will stand up for the merchants." "Then you must put up a rival candidate," Dick said. "Will you stand?" she asked him directly. He shook his head. "Don't bother trying to persuade me. At the end of this week, I'm handing over to my eldest son. I'm planning to spend the rest of my days drinking beer instead of brewing it." He took a long draught from his tankard and belched contentedly. Caris felt she had to accept that. He seemed quite sure. She said, "Who do you think we might approach?" "There's only one real possibility," he said. "You." Caris was astonished. "Me? Why?" "You're the driving force behind the campaign for a borough charter. Your fiancé's bridge has saved the Fleece Fair, and your cloth business has pretty much rescued the town's prosperity after the wool slump. You're the child of the existing alderman, and although it's not an inherited office, people think leaders breed leaders. And they're right. You've actually been acting as alderman for almost a year, ever since your father's powers started to fail."
"Has the town ever had a woman alderman?"
"Not as far as I know. Nor one as young as you. Both these things will count heavily against you. I'm not saying you're going to win. I'm telling you no one else has a better chance of beating Elfric."
Caris had a faintly dizzy feeling. Was it possible? Could she do the job? What about her vow to become a healer? Were there not many other people in town who would be better than she as alderman? "What about Mark Webber?" she said. "He'd be good, especially with that shrewd wife of his at his side. But people in this town still think of Mark as a poor weaver. He's prosperous now, thanks to your scarlet cloth. But people are suspicious of new money. They would just say Mark is a jumped-up weaver. They want an alderman from a well-established family, someone whose father was rich and preferably grandfather, too." Caris wanted to beat Alfric, but she did not feel sure of her ability. She thought of her father's patience and shrewdness, his hearty conviviality, his inexhaustible energy. Did she have any such qualities? She looked at Merthyn. He said, "You would be the best alderman the town has ever had." His unhesitating confidence decided her. "All right," she said. "I'll do it." Godwin invited Alfric to dine with him on the Friday of the fair. He ordered an expensive dinner, swan, cooked with ginger and honey. Philemon served them and sat down to eat with them. The citizens had decided to elect a new alderman, and in a remarkably short time, two candidates had emerged as the principal contestants, Alfric and Carus. Godwin did not like Alfric, but he was useful. He was not a particularly good builder, but he had successfully ingratiated himself with Prior Antony, and thereby gained the contract for cathedral repairs. When Godwin took office, he had seen in Alfric a servile toady, and had kept him on. Alfric was not well liked, but he either employed or subcontracted most of the building craftsmen and suppliers in town, and they, in their turn, courted him in the hope of work. Having won his confidence, they all wanted him to continue in a position where he could grant them favours, and that gave him a power base. "I don't like uncertainty," Godwin said. Alfric tasted the swan and grunted appreciatively. "In what context?" "The election of a new alderman. By its nature, an election is uncertain, unless there is only one candidate. Which would be my preference?"
"Mine too, providing that candidate was me."
"That's what I'm suggesting." Alfric looked up from his dinner.
"Really?
Tell me, Alfric, how badly do you want to be alderman?" Alfric swallowed his mouthful.
"I want it," he said.
His voice sounded a little hoarse, and he slurped some wine.
"I deserve it,"
he went on, a note of indignation creeping into his tone. "I'm as good as any of them, am I not? Why should I not be alderman?" "Would you proceed with the application for a borough charter?" Alfric stared at him. Thoughtfully, he said,
"Are you asking me to withdraw it?"
"If you're elected alderman, yes."
"Are you offering to help me get elected?"
"Yes."
"But how?"
"By eliminating the rival candidate." Alfric looked sceptical.
"I don't see how you could achieve that."
Godwin nodded to Philemon, who said, "I believe Carus is a heretic." Alfric dropped his knife.
"You're going to try Carus as a witch?"
"You must not tell anyone about this," Philemon said. "If she hears about it beforehand, she may flee,
as Matty Wise did.
I have let some townspeople believe that Matty has been captured, and it is she who will be tried on Saturday at the ecclesiastical court. But, at the last minute, a different person will be accused." Alfric nodded.
"And as it's an ecclesiastical court, there is conveniently no need for indictments or juries."
He turned to Godwin. "And you will be judge?"
"Unfortunately, no," Godwin said. "Bishop Richard will preside. So we must prove our point."
"Have you any evidence?" Alfric said sceptically.
Godwin replied,
"Some, but we'd like more. What we already have would be plenty if the accused were some old woman with no family or friends, like Crazy Nell. But Carus is well known and comes from a wealthy and influential family, as I need hardly tell you."
Philemon put in, "It's extremely fortunate for us that her father is too ill to leave his bed. God has ordained it so that he will not be able to defend her." Godwin nodded. "Nevertheless, she has many friends, so our evidence must be strong."
"What have you got in mind?" said Alfric.
Philemon answered, "It would be helpful if a member of her family were to come forward and say that she had called upon the devil, or turned a crucifix upside down, or spoken to some presence in an empty room." For a moment, Alfric looked as if he did not understand. Then enlightenment dawned.
"Oh," he said, "you mean me."
"Think very carefully before you answer. You're asking me to help send my sister-in-law to Gallows Cross." Godwin said, "Your sister-in-law?
My cousin?"
"Yes."
"All right. I'm thinking."
Godwin saw on Elfric's face ambition, greed, and vain glory, and he marveled at the way God used even men's weaknesses to his holy purpose. He could guess what Elfric was thinking. The position of alderman was a burdensome task for an unselfish man such as Edmund, who exercised his power for the benefit of the town's merchants. But for someone with his eye on the main chance, it offered endless opportunities for profit and self-aggrandizement. Philemon continued in a smooth, assured voice, "If you have never witnessed anything suspicious, then, of course, that is the end of the matter. But I beg you to search your memory carefully." Godwin noticed again how much Philemon had learned in the last 2 years. The awkward priory servant had vanished. He talked like an archdeacon. There may have been incidents that seemed at the time perfectly harmless, but which take on a sinister cast in the light of what you have been told today. On mature reflection, you may feel that these events were not as innocent as they at first appeared. "I get your meaning, brother," Elfric said. There was a long silence. None of them ate. Godwin waited patiently for Elfric's decision. Philemon said, "And, of course, if Carys were dead, then Edmund's entire fortune would come to the other sister, Alice, your wife." "Yes," Elfric said, "I'd thought of that." "Well," said Philemon, "is there anything you can think of that might help us?" "Oh, yes," Elfric said at last. "I can think of quite a lot." Chapter 42. Carys was unable to find out the truth about Matty Wise. Some people said she had been captured and was locked in a cell in the priory. Others thought she would be tried in her absence. A third strand of opinion claimed that someone else entirely would stand trial for heresy. Godwin refused to answer Carys's questions, and the rest of the monks said they knew nothing. Carys went to the cathedral on Saturday morning, determined to defend Matty whether she was present or not, and to stand up for any other poor old woman who suffered this absurd accusation. Why did monks and priests hate women so? They worshipped their Blessed Virgin, but treated every other female as an incarnation of the devil. What was the matter with them? In a secular court, there would have been a jury of indictment and a preliminary hearing, and Carys would have been able to find out in advance what the evidence against Matty might be. But the church made its own rules. Whatever they alleged, Carys would say loud and clear that Matty was a genuine healer who used herbs and drugs and told people to pray to God to make them well. Some of the many townspeople who had been helped by Matty would surely speak up for her. Carys stood with Merthyn in the north transept, and remembered the Saturday 2 years ago when Crazy Nell had been tried. Carys had told the court Nell was mad but harmless. It had done no good. Today, as then, there was a big crowd of townspeople and visitors in the cathedral, hoping for drama. Accusations, counter-accusations, quarrels, hysterics, curses, and the spectacle of a woman being flogged through the streets and then hanged at Gallows Cross. Friar Murdo was present. He always showed up for sensational trials. They provided an opportunity for him to do what he did best, whip up hysteria in a congregation. While they were waiting for the clergy, Carys's mind wandered. Tomorrow, in this church, she would marry Merthyn. Betty Baxter and her four daughters were already busy making the bread and pastry for the feast. Tomorrow night, Carys and Merthyn would sleep together in his house on Leper Island. She had stopped worrying about the marriage. She had made her decision, and she would take the consequences. In truth, she felt very happy. Sometimes she wondered how she could have been so scared. Merthyn could not make anyone his slave. It was not in his nature. He was even kind to his boy laborer, Jimmy. Most of all, she loved their sexual intimacy. It was the best thing that had ever happened to her. What she looked forward to most was having a home and a bed of their own, and being able to make love whenever they wanted to, on going to bed or on waking up, in the middle of the night, or even the middle of the day. At last the monks and nuns came in, led by Bishop Richard with his assistant, Archdeacon Lloyd. When they had taken their seats, Prior Godwin stood up and said, "We are here today to try the charge of heresy against Caris, daughter of Edmund Wooler." The crowd gasped. Merthin shouted, "No!" Everyone turned to look at Caris. She felt sick with fear. She had had no suspicion of this. It hit her like a punch in the dark. Bewildered, she said, "Why?" No one answered her. She remembered her father warning her that Godwin would have an extreme reaction to the threat of a borough charter. "You know how ruthless he is, even over small disputes," Edmund had said. "Something like this will lead to total war." Caris shuddered now to remember her reply. "So be it. Total war." Even so, Godwin's chance of success would have been slender indeed if her father had been in good health. Edmund would have fought Godwin to a standstill and probably destroyed him. But Caris alone was a different matter. She did not have her father's power, authority, or popular support. Not yet. Without him, she had become vulnerable. She noticed her aunt Petronilla in the crowd. She was one of the few people not looking at Caris. How could she stand there in silence? Of course she supported her son Godwin in general, but surely she would try to stop him condemning Caris to death. She had once said she wanted to be like a mother to Caris. Would she remember that? Somehow Caris felt she would not. Her devotion to her son was too great. That was why she could not meet Caris's eye. She had already made up her mind not to stand in Godwin's way. Philemon stood up. "My lord bishop," he said, formally addressing the judge, but he immediately turned to the crowd. "As everyone knows, the woman Mattie Wise has fled, too frightened and guilty to be tried. Caris has been a regular visitor to Mattie's house for some years. Only days ago she defended the woman in front of witnesses here in the cathedral." So that was why Philemon had questioned her about Mattie, Caris realized. She caught Merthin's eye. He had been worried because he could not figure out what Philemon was up to. He had been right to worry. Now they knew. At the same time, part of her mind marveled at the transformation of Philemon. That awkward, unhappy boy was now a confident, arrogant man, standing in front of the bishop, the prior, and the townspeople, as full of spite as a snake about to strike. Philemon said, "She offered to swear on oath that Mattie is no witch. Why would she do that, unless to cover her own guilt?" Merthin shouted out, "Because she's innocent, and so is Mattie, you mendacious hypocrite!" He might have been put in the stocks for that, but others were shouting at the same time, and his insult passed without comment. Philemon went on, "Recently, Caris has miraculously dyed wool the exact shade of Italian scarlet, something Kingsbridge dyers have never been able to do. How has this been achieved? By a magic spell." Caris heard the rumble of Mark Webber's bass voice. "This is a lie." "She could not do this by daylight, of course. She lit a fire in her backyard at night, as was seen by people living nearby." Philemon had been assiduous, Caris noted with foreboding. He had interviewed her neighbors. "And she chanted strange rhymes." "Why?" Caris had sung to herself out of boredom, as she boiled up dyes and dipped the cloth. But Philemon had the ability to turn innocent trivia into evidence of evil. He dropped his voice to a thrilling stage whisper and said, "Because she was calling for the secret aid of the Prince of Darkness." He raised his voice to a shout, "Lucifer!" The crowd groaned with dread. "That cloth is Satan's scarlet." Caris looked at Merthin. He was aghast. "The fools are starting to believe him," he said. Caris's courage began to return. "Don't despair," she said. "I haven't had my say yet." He took her hand. "This is not the only spell she has used," Philemon continued in a more normal voice. "Matty Wise also made love potions." He looked accusing around the crowd. "There may even be wicked girls in this church now who have made use of Matty's powers to bewitch a man." "Including your own sister," Caris thought. "Did Philemon know about that?" He said, "This novice nun will testify." Elizabeth Clark stood up. She spoke in a quiet voice, eyes lowered, the picture of nun-like modesty. "I say this on my oath, as I hope to be saved," she began. "I was betrothed to Merthyn Builder." Merthyn called out, "Liar!" "We were in love, and very happy," Elizabeth went on. "Suddenly he changed. He seemed like a stranger to me. He became cold." Philemon asked her, "Did you notice anything else unusual, sister?" "Yes, brother. I saw him hold his knife in his left hand." The crowd gasped. This was an acknowledged sign of bewitchment, although, as Caris knew, Merthyn was ambidextrous. Elizabeth said, "Then he announced he was going to marry Caris." It was amazing, Caris thought, how the truth could be just a little skewed so that it sounded sinister. She knew what had really happened. Merthyn and Elizabeth had been friends, until Elizabeth made it clear she wanted to be more than a friend, at which point he had told her that he did not share her feelings, and they had parted. But a satanic spell made a much better story. Elizabeth might have convinced herself that she was telling the truth, but Philemon knew this was a lie, and Philemon was Godwin's tool. How could Godwin reconcile his conscience with this level of wickedness? Was he telling himself that anything was justified in the service of the priory? Elizabeth finished. "I can never love another man. That is why I have decided to give my life to God." She sat down. It was powerful evidence, Caris realized, and her dismay darkened like a winter sky. The fact that Elizabeth had become a nun lent conviction to her testimony. She was operating a kind of sentimental blackmail. "How can you disbelieve me when I have made such a sacrifice?" The townspeople were quieter now. This was not the hilarious spectacle of a mad old woman being condemned. They were watching a battle for the life of a fellow citizen. Philemon said, "Most damning of all, my Lord Bishop, is the final witness, a close member of the accused woman's own family, her brother-in-law, Elfric Builder." Caris gasped. She had been accused by her cousin Godwin, by her best friend's brother, Philemon, and by Elizabeth. But this was worse. For her sister's husband to speak against her was astonishing treachery. Surely no one would ever respect Elfric again. Elfric stood up. The expression of defiance on his face told Caris he was ashamed of himself. "I say this on my oath as I hope to be saved," he began. Caris looked around for her sister Alice, but did not see her. If she had been here, she would surely have stopped Elfric. No doubt Elfric had ordered her to stay at home on some pretext. She probably knew nothing of this. Elfric said, "Caris speaks to unseen presences in empty rooms." "Spirits," Philemon prompted. "I fear so." A murmur of horror came from the crowd. Caris was aware that she often talked aloud to herself. She had always thought of it as a harmless, if mildly embarrassing, habit. Her father said all imaginative people did it. Now it was being used to condemn her. She bit back a protest. It was better to let the prosecution run its course, than refute the accusations one by one. "When does she do this?" Philemon asked Elfric. "When she thinks she is alone." "And what does she say?" "The words are difficult to make out. She might be speaking a foreign tongue." The crowd reacted to that, too. Witches and their familiars were said to have their own language that no one else could understand. What does she seem to be saying? To judge by her tone of voice, she is asking for help, pleading for good luck, cursing those who cause her misfortune, that sort of thing. Merthin shouted, "This is not evidence!" Everyone looked at him, and he added, "He has admitted he did not understand the words. He's just making this up!" There was a rumble of support from the more level-headed citizens, but it was not as loud or as indignant as Caris would have liked. Bishop Richard spoke for the first time. "Be quiet," he said. "Men who disrupt the proceedings will be put outside by the constable. Carry on, please, Brother Philemon, but do not invite witnesses to fabricate evidence when they have admitted they do not know the truth." That was at least even-handed, Caris thought. Richard and his family had no love for Godwin after the quarrel over Marjorie's wedding. On the other hand, as a cleric, Richard might not want the town to pass out of the priory's control. Perhaps he would at least be neutral in this. Her hopes rose a little. Philemon said to Elfric, "Do you think the familiars she speaks to help her in any way?" "Most certainly," Elfric replied. "Caris's friends, those she favors, are lucky. Merthin has become a successful builder, although he never even completed his apprenticeship as a carpenter. Mark Webber was a poor man, but now he is rich. Caris's friend Gwenda is married to Wulfric, even though Wulfric was betrothed to someone else. How are these things achieved, if not with unnatural help?" "Thank you." Elfric sat down. As Philemon summarized his evidence, Caris fought down a rising feeling of terror. She tried to put out of her mind the vision of Crazy Nell being flogged behind a cart. She struggled to concentrate on what she should say to defend herself. She could ridicule every statement made about her, but that might not be enough. She needed to explain why people had lied about her and show what their motives were. When Philemon was finished, Godwin asked her if she had anything to say. In a loud voice that sounded more confident than she felt, she replied, "Of course I do." She made her way to the front of the crowd. She would not let her accusers monopolize the position of authority. She took her time, making them all wait for her. She walked up to the throne and looked Richard in the eye. "My Lord Bishop, I say this on my oath, as I hope to be saved." She turned to the crowd and added, "Which I notice Philemon did not say." Godwin interrupted, "As a monk, he does not need to swear." Caris raised her voice, "And a good thing for him, otherwise he would burn in hell for the lies he has told today." "Score a point to me," she thought, and her hopes rose another notch. She spoke to the crowd. Although the decision would be made by the bishop, he would be heavily influenced by the reaction of the townspeople. He was not a man of high principle. "Matthew Wise healed many people in this town," she began. "On this day 2 years ago, when the old bridge collapsed, she was one of the foremost in tending to the injured, working alongside Mother Cecilia and the nuns. Looking around the church today, I see many people who benefited from her care at that terrible time. Did anyone hear her invoke the devil on that day? If so, let him speak now." She paused to let the silence impress itself on her audience. She pointed at Madge Webber. "Matty gave you a potion that brought down your child's fever. What did she say to you?" Madge looked scared. No one was comfortable being called as a witness in the defense of a witch. But Madge owed a lot to Caris. She straightened her shoulders, looked defiant, and said, "Matty said to me, 'Pray to God, for only he can heal.'" Caris pointed at the constable. "John, she eased your pain while Matthew Barber set your broken bones. What did she say to you?" John was used to being on the prosecuting side, and he too looked uneasy, but he told the truth in a strong voice. "She said, 'Pray to God, for only he can heal.'" Caris turned to the crowd. "Everyone knows that Matty was no witch." "In that case, says Brother Philemon,
Why did she flee? Easy question. She was afraid that lies would be told about her, as they have been told about me. Which of you women, if falsely accused of heresy, would feel confident about proving your innocence to a court of priests and monks? She looked around, letting her eyes rest on the prominent women of the town, Lib Wheeler, Sarah Taverner, Susanna Chepstow. Why did I mix dyes at night? She resumed. Because the days were short. Like many of you, my father failed to sell all his fleeces last year, and I wanted to turn the raw wool into something I could market. It was very difficult to discover the formula, but I did it, by hard work, over many hours, day and night, but without the help of Satan. She paused for breath. When she began again, she used a different tone of voice, more playful. I am accused of bewitching Merthin. I have to admit that the case against me is strong. Look at Sister Elizabeth. Stand up, please, sister. Reluctantly, Elizabeth stood. She is beautiful, isn't she? Caris said. She is also clever, and she is the daughter of a bishop. Oh, forgive me, my lord bishop. I meant no disrespect. The crowd chuckled at that cheeky stab. Godwin looked outraged, but Bishop Richard smothered a smile. Sister Elizabeth cannot see why any man would prefer me to her. Nor can I. Unaccountably, Merthin loves me, plain as I am. I cannot explain it. There was more giggling. I'm sorry Elizabeth is so angry. If we lived in Old Testament times, Merthin could have two wives and everyone would be happy. They laughed loudly at that. She waited for the sound to subside, then said gravely, What I am most sorry about is that the commonplace jealousy of a disappointed woman should become the pretext in the untrustworthy mouth of a novice monk for a charge as serious as that of heresy. Philemon stood up to protest the charge of untrustworthiness, but Bishop Richard flapped a hand at him, saying, Let her speak, let her speak. Caris decided she had made her point about Elizabeth, and moved on. I confess that I sometimes use vulgar words when I am alone, especially if I stub my toe. But you may ask why my own brother-in-law would testify against me, and tell you that my mutterings were invocations to evil spirits. I'm afraid I can answer that. She paused, then spoke solemnly. My father is ill. If he dies, his fortune will be divided between me and my sister. But, if I die first, my sister will get it all, and my sister is Elfric's wife. She paused, looking quizzically at the crowd. Are you shocked? She said. So am I. But men kill for less money than that. She moved away as if she had finished, and Philemon got up from his bench. Caris turned around and addressed him in Latin. Caput tuum in ano est. The monks laughed loudly, and Philemon flushed. Caris turned to Elfric. You didn't understand that, did you, Elfric? No, he said sulkily, which is why you might have thought I was using some sinister witchcraft tongue. She turned back to Philemon. Brother, you know what language I was using, don't you? Latin, Philemon replied. Perhaps you would tell us what I just said to you. Philemon looked an appeal at the bishop, but Richard was amused and just said, Answer the question. Looking furious, Philemon obeyed. She said, You've got your head up your ass. The townspeople roared with laughter, and Caris walked back to her place. When the noise died down, Philemon began to speak, but Richard interrupted him. I don't need to hear any further from you, he said. You've made a strong case against her, and she has mounted a vigorous defense. Does anyone else have anything to say about this accusation?
I do, my lord bishop.
Friar Murdo came forward. Some of the townspeople cheered, others groaned. Murdo aroused contrary reactions.
Heresy is an evil, he began, his voice modulating into fruity preaching mode.
It corrupts the souls of women and men.
Thank you, brother, but I know what heresy does, said Richard. Do you have anything else to say? If not,
just this, Murdo replied. I agree with and reiterate,
if it has been said before,
your own comment, that the case is strong and the defense similar, in which case I have a solution to propose.
All right, Brother Murdo, what is it? In the minimum number of words.
She must be examined for the devil's mark.
Caris's heart seemed to stop.
Of course, said the bishop. I seem to remember you making the same suggestion at an earlier trial.
Indeed, Lord. For the devil greedily sucks the hot blood of his acolytes through his own special nipple, as the newborn babe sucks the swollen breasts.
Yes, thank you, Friar. No need for further details. Mother Cecilia, will you and two other nuns please take the accused woman to a place of examination?
Caris looked at Merthin. He was pale with horror. They were both thinking the same. Caris had a mole. It was tiny, but the nuns would find it, in just the kind of place they thought the devil was most interested in, on the left side of her vulva, just beside the cleft. It was dark brown, and the red-gold hair around did not hide it. The first time Merthin had noticed it, he had joked, Friar Murdo would call you a witch. You'd better not let him see it. And Caris had laughed and said, not if he were the last man on earth. How could they have spoken of it in such a carefree way? Now she would be condemned to death for it. She looked around desperately. She would have run, but she was surrounded by hundreds of people, some of whom would stop her. She saw Merthin's hand on the knife at his belt, but even if the knife had been a sword, and he had been a great fighter, which he was not, he could not have cut his way through such a crowd. Mother Cecilia came to her and took her hand. Caris decided she would escape as soon as she got outside the church. Crossing the cloisters, she could easily break free. Then Godwin said, Constable, take one of your deputies and escort the woman to the place of examination, and stand outside the door until it is done. Cecilia could not have held Caris, but two men could. John looked at Mark Webber, normally his first choice among the deputies. Caris felt a faint hope. Mark was a loyal friend to her, but the constable apparently had the same thought, for he turned from Mark and pointed to Christopher Blacksmith. Cecilia tugged gently on Caris's hand. As if sleepwalking, Caris allowed herself to be led out of the church. They left by the north door, Cecilia and Caris, followed by Sister Mare and old Julie, with John Constable and Christopher Blacksmith close behind. They crossed the cloisters, entered the nuns' quarters, and made their way to the dormitory. The two men stayed outside. Cecilia closed the door. No need to examine me, Caris said dully. I've got a mark.
We know, said Cecilia.
Caris frowned.
How?
We have washed you. She indicated Mare and Julie, all three of us, when you were in the hospital 2 Christmases ago. You had eaten something that poisoned you. Cecilia did not know, or was pretending not to have guessed, that Caris had taken a potion to end her pregnancy. She went on, You were puking and shitting all over the place, and bleeding down there. You had to be washed several times. We all saw the mole. Hopeless despair washed over Caris in an irresistible tide. She closed her eyes. So now you will condemn me to death, she said in a voice so low it was almost a whisper.
Not necessarily, said Cecilia. There could be another way.
Merthin was distraught. Caris was trapped. She would be condemned to death, and there was nothing he could do. He could not have rescued her even if he had been Ralph, with big shoulders and a sword and a relish for violence. He stared, horrified, at the door through which she had disappeared. He knew where Caris's mole was,
and he felt sure the nuns would find it. That was just the kind of place where they would look most carefully. All around him, the noise of excited chatter rose from the crowd. People were arguing for or against Karis, rerunning the trial, but he seemed to be inside a bubble, and he could hardly follow what anyone said. In his ears, their talk sounded like the random beating of 100 drums. He found himself staring at Godwin, wondering what he was thinking. Merthin could understand the others. Elizabeth was eaten up with jealousy, Elfric was possessed by greed, and Philemon was pure malevolence. But the prior mystified him. Godwin had grown up with his cousin Karis, and he knew she was not a witch. Yet he was prepared to see her die. How could he do something so wicked? What excuse did he make to himself? Did he tell himself that this was all for the glory of God? Godwin had once seemed to be a man of enlightenment and decency, the antidote to Prior Antony's narrow conservatism, but he had turned out to be worse than Antony, more ruthless in the pursuit of the same obsolete aims. If Karis dies, Merthin thought, I'm going to kill Godwin. His parents came up to him. They had been in the cathedral throughout the trial. His father said something, but Merthin could not understand him. What? He said. Then the north door opened, and the crowd became silent. Mother Cecilia walked in alone and closed the door behind her. There was a murmur of curiosity. What now? Cecilia walked up to the bishop's throne. Richard said, Well, Mother Prioress, what do you have to report to the court? Cecilia said slowly, Karis has confessed. There was a roar of shock from the crowd. Cecilia raised her voice. Confessed her sins. They went quiet again. What did this mean? She has received absolution. From whom? Godwin interrupted. A nun cannot give absolution. From Father Geoffroy. Merthin knew Geoffroy. He was the priest at St. Mark's, the church where Merthin had repaired the roof. Geoffroy had no love for Godwin. But what was going on? Everyone waited for Cecilia to explain. She said, Karis has applied to become a novice nun here at the priory. Once again she was interrupted by a shout of shock from the assembled townspeople. She yelled over their voices, And I have accepted her! There was uproar. Merthin could see Godwin yelling at the top of his voice, but his words were lost. Elizabeth was enraged. Philemon stared at Cecilia with poisonous hatred. Elfric looked bewildered. Richard was amused. Merthin's own mind reeled with the implications. Would the bishop accept this? Did it mean the trial was over? Had Karis been saved from execution? Eventually the tumult died down. As soon as he could be heard, Godwin spoke, his face white with fury. Did she, or did she not, confess to heresy? The confessional is a sacred trust, Cecilia replied imperturbably. I don't know what she said to the priest, and if I did, I could not tell you or anyone else. Does she bear the mark of Satan? We did not examine her. This answer was evasive, Merthin realized, but Cecilia quickly added, It was not necessary, once she had received absolution. This is unacceptable! Godwin bellowed. He had dropped the pretense that Philemon was the prosecutor. The prioress cannot frustrate the proceedings of the court in this way! Bishop Richard said, Thank you, Father Prior. The order of the court must be carried out! Richard raised his voice. That will do! Godwin opened his mouth to protest further, then thought better of it. Richard said, I don't need to hear any more argument. I have made my decision, and I will now announce my judgment. Silence fell. The proposal that Karis be permitted to enter the nunnery is an interesting one. If she is a witch, she will be unable to do any harm in the holiness of her surroundings. The devil cannot enter here. On the other hand, if she is not a witch, we will have been saved from the error of condemning an innocent woman. Perhaps the nunnery would not have been Caris's choice as a way of life, but her consolation will be an existence dedicated to serving God. On balance, then, I find this a satisfactory solution. Godwin said, "What if she should leave the nunnery?" "Good point," said the bishop. "That is why I am formally sentencing her to death, but suspending the sentence for as long as she remains a nun. If she should renounce her vows, the sentence would be carried out." "That's it," thought Merthin in despair. "A life sentence." And he felt tears of rage and grief come to his eyes. Richard stood up. Godwin said, "The court is adjourned." The bishop left, followed by the monks and nuns in procession. Merthin moved in a daze. His mother spoke to him in a consoling voice, but he ignored her. He let the crowd carry him to the great west door of the cathedral and out onto the green. The traders were packing up their leftover goods and dismantling their stalls. The fleece fair was over for another year. Godwin had got what he wanted, he realized. With Edmund dying and Caris out of the way, Elfric would become alderman, and the application for a borough charter would be withdrawn. He looked at the grey stone walls of the priory buildings. Caris was in there somewhere. He turned that way, moving across the tide of the crowd, and headed for the hospital. The place was empty. It had been swept clean, and the straw-filled palliasses used by the overnight visitors were stacked neatly against the walls. A candle burned on the altar at the eastern end. Merthin walked slowly the length of the room, not sure what to do next. He recalled, from Timothy's book, that his ancestor Jack Builder had briefly become a novice monk. The author had hinted that Jack had been a reluctant recruit and had not taken easily to monastic discipline. At any rate, his novitiate had ended abruptly in circumstances over which Timothy drew a tactful veil. But Bishop Richard had stated that if Caris ever left the nunnery, she would be under sentence of death. A young nun came in. When she recognized Merthin, she looked scared. "What do you want?" she said. "I must speak to Caris." "I'll go and ask," she said, and hurried out. Merthin looked at the altar and the crucifix, and the triptych on the wall showing Elizabeth of Hungary, the patron saint of hospitals. One panel showed the saint, who had been a princess, wearing a crown and feeding the poor. The second showed her building her hospital, and the third illustrated the miracle in which the food she carried beneath her cloak was turned into roses. What would Caris do in this place? She was a skeptic, doubtful of just about everything the church taught. She did not believe that a princess could turn bread into roses. "How do they know that?" she would say to stories that everyone else accepted without question. Adam and Eve, Noah's Ark, David and Goliath, even the Nativity. She would be a caged wildcat in here. He had to talk to her, to find out what was in her mind. She must have some plan that he was not able to guess at. He waited impatiently for the nun to return. She did not come back, but old Julie appeared. "Thank heaven," he said. "Julie, I have to see Caris, quickly." "I'm sorry, young Merthin," she said. "Caris doesn't want to see you." "Don't be ridiculous," he said. "We're betrothed. We're supposed to get married tomorrow. She has to see me." "She's a novice nun now. She won't be getting married." Merthin raised his voice. "If that's true, don't you think she should tell me herself?" "It's not for me to say. She knows you're here, and she won't see you." "I don't believe you." Merthin pushed past the old nun and went through the door by which she had entered. He found himself in a small lobby. He had never been here before. Few men had ever entered the nun's area of the priory. He passed through another door and found himself in the nun's cloisters. Several of them stood there, some reading, some walking around the square meditatively,
some talking in quiet voices. He ran along the arcade. A nun caught sight of him and screamed. He ignored her. Seeing a staircase, he ran up it and entered the first room. He found himself in a dormitory. There were two lines of mattresses with neatly folded blankets on top. No one was there. He went a few